behalf of the appellants, First State Depository and its affiliate Certified Assets Management. First State Depository is a depository of rare coins and precious metals, and CAMI was a wholesaler of rare coins and precious metals. Today's hearing calls on the court to consider the circumstances by which a non-signatory may be compelled to arbitrate where it is the express third-party beneficiary of the contract containing the arbitration clause and the claims that it sues on are integrally related to that contract. It is in this context that we revisit two of this court's seminal decisions on arbitrability, and we seek reversal of the Court of Chancery's decision denying the appellant's motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The first issue is
Ms. Joyce, let me just ask you a fundamental question. Would you agree that no party could be forced to arbitrate unless there's an agreement to arbitrate?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you also agree that that an agreement to arbitrate can take either the form of an express contract, that is a writing, you know, which expressly agrees to arbitration, or a contract which incorporates by reference some other document or agreement that constitutes an assent to arbitrate?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's exactly the circumstances that we have before the court today.
Go ahead.
Okay. And I'd like to talk about those contracts to put the dispute today in context for the court.
But your theory is that the agreement to arbitrate is incorporated by reference into the contract that First Israel Bank did sign.
That's correct, Your Honor. The bailment agreement, we submit that there's really three theories on the four corners of the bailment agreement that IDB sued on that the court could rely upon to find that they agreed to arbitrate. The first is the invocation of the express third-party beneficiary clause. And in addition to that, you have the incorporation of the collateral custody account agreements multiple places throughout the four corners of the bailment agreement. And you also have the situation...
Well, where in the bailment agreement, which language do you rely on incorporating by reference the arbitration provisions?
Your Honor, we rely on the incorporation of the entire contract and the series of contracts of collateral custody account agreements without exception. When they wrote the bailment agreement, and when Your Honor looks at that first paragraph of the bailment agreement, you'll see that they defined these contracts as separate agreements between Bailey Company and Company's clients, collectively and individually, the contracts. And Bailey and Company acknowledge and agree that the secured party is a third-party beneficiary of such contracts. So they're saying that they are a third-party beneficiary of each and every one of the CCAAs in their entirety and without limitation. If IDB did not want to arbitrate under the CCAAs, it had its ability to carve out that provision here, and we see that in some of the cases.
Well, how is that an assent to arbitration?
Your Honor, by virtue of the multiple places where it has done this, the CCAA is referenced numerous times in the four corners of the bailment agreement. We see it first in the opening paragraph. We see it in Section 2 under safekeeping and inspection with reference to those contracts. We see it in the insurance provision. And we see it by implication in Section 6 when they say, until Bailey has received written notification to the contrary, Bailey can continue to release the property in accordance with instructions issued by the company. That is essentially saying by implication, in accordance with instructions under the CCAAs. You simply cannot read the bailment agreement without referring to the CCAAs, because it is those documents that identify the specific custody accounts that IDB is seeking to provide instructions regarding. And we know this by looking at the way that they pled in their complaint. In paragraph 18 of the complaint, they specifically referenced the four accounts that were created under each of the CCAAs.
So your theory is that that portion of the bailment agreement that provides that, or maybe it's a CCH agreement, which provides that the Israel Bank is a third party beneficiary, for that reason alone constitutes an incorporation by reference of the arbitration provisions of the letter contracts?
Yes, Your Honor. It's an incorporation by reference, really, of the entirety of those agreements.
Well, you say that, but the question is whether that is the case. That's one question. And the second question is, even if it is the case, whether the claim that the Israel Bank is asserting here is to enforce any portion of that separate agreement.
Yes, Your Honor, and we contend that it is. First of all, you look on a subject matter jurisdiction challenge, the plaintiff has the burden to plead so in the complaint. So the plaintiff is stuck with what was pled in the complaint. And the allegations of the complaint made clear that they were asserting rights, and we see this in paragraph 51 of the complaint, they're asserting rights that arise out of both of the contracts. That's the first thing. Then, even if you accept the Vice Chancellor's characterization that the claim was simply exclusive control, then you say, exclusive control over what? The what is not stated with sufficient specificity within the four corners of the bailment agreement. You must look to those CCAAs.
And well, the Vice Chancellor found that the relevant language of the arbitration clause does not provide for arbitration of all disputes. Is that incorrect?
Yes, Your Honor, that is incorrect. And the reason...
But there is a carve-out. You do concede that.
Of course, Your Honor. There's absolutely a carve-out.
And well, the carve-out... Why doesn't that, by virtue of the carve-out, mean that it does not provide for all disputes?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. There have been a number of cases where the Court of Chancery, in interpreting this Court's decision in Willie Gary, has found that the presence of a narrow carve-out does not necessarily take it out of the arbitrability determination. And here, the language of this clause is that except for interpleader suits, well, under the terms of the CCAAs, only FSD could initiate an interpleader suit. So by ruling that, by analogizing IDB's claims to an interpleader suit, the court was saying that IDB had a greater rights than the bundle of rights that it received standing in the shoes of Republic as a third-party beneficiary. If Republic had no right to initiate an interpleader action, then neither did IDB.
And well, let me interrupt because I'm frankly confused here. If a particular entity is a third-party beneficiary to a contract that it is not a party to, and arguably if in the capacity as a third-party beneficiary that entity attempted to sue one of the parties to the contract, then it seems understandable that to the extent that they state a cause of action, it would be controlled by something like an arbitration provision in that contract. But I thought here we're talking about a separate contract that is the subject of the current lawsuit, and that being the bailment agreement. So even if you are a third-party beneficiary to another set of contracts, if you're suing on a different contract, how do you simply sweep all of those other provisions into the bailment agreement suit?
Well, Your Honor, we contend that the bailment agreement cannot be read on its own. And in addition, on the face of the complaint, at the time the complaint was filed, IDB had sued on a CCAA. It had sued on a contract that it signed with the arbitration clause that it negotiated specifically with FSD and did not strike the arbitration provision.
What does that have to do with this situation? That's not this suit, is it?
Yes, Your Honor. The claims brought in the complaint were two counts. Count one was for breach of contract, where they sued for breach of the 2009 collateral custody account agreement that IDB itself had entered into with an arbitration clause, and it also sued for breach of the bailment agreement.
But the first claim became moot correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. There was a resolution of that action.
How can a moot claim control the outcome of the other claim?
It's certainly not controlling, Your Honor, because we contend that the incorporation by reference provision combined with the totality of the relationship of these parties and the fact that the claim on IDB's claim for control under paragraph 6 of the bailment agreement can't be read without reference to the instructions that Republic was giving under the CCAAs. So for that reason, the contracts must be read together. And in addition, you look at the circumstances that the bailment agreement was entered into. It was entered into only 60 days after the amended financing agreement was entered into between IDB and Republic. And that's the loan agreement that is Exhibit A to the complaint.
All right, let me try a different approach. There are all kinds of substantive provisions in the various contracts. I don't think anybody is claiming that the bailment agreement does not incorporate by reference some of those provisions and that the contracts are clearly tied together in a certain way. But an arbitration clause is a slightly different animal, isn't it? It is not a substantive provision with respect to who's going to pay money or who has to do what in a contract. It is substantive in the sense that it tells you how you're allowed to litigate. But so where is the law that says that if you've incorporated the substantive terms of another agreement, you've also incorporated the arbitration clause in that other agreement?
Well, Your Honor, the Court of Chancery, in addressing the circumstances under which the non-signatory can be bound, has relied on Second and Third Circuit authority. We recognize that this Court hasn't addressed that issue yet. And in those instances, the Court has found whether it's the – here you have really three bases to say. In the totality of the circumstances here, which is the standard that our former Chief Justice applied in the Westendorf case, you have an express third-party beneficiary provision, you have numerous incorporations by reference, and you have IDB receiving the benefits of the CCAAs for nearly 5 years before a dispute arose.
Okay. So the case you're relying on is what? I didn't catch that.
Your Honor, the NAMA Holdings case is one where...
The what Holdings?
NAMA Holdings.
Okay.
And there the court is citing to the DuPont, the DuPont versus Rome-Polonc case from the Third Circuit and the Thompson CSF case from the Second Circuit where the agency and contract principles have been articulated which would allow a non-signatory to be bound. Certainly this is the first time these facts have been presented to this court.
You're saying a non-signatory to be bound to an arbitration clause?
Correct, Your Honor.
How would you characterize or articulate what you believe is the pivotal, critical legal issue that we have to decide? And how would we express in an opinion the ruling of law that you would ask us to make?
Your Honor, we would ask for a ruling of law that a non-signatory can be bound to an arbitration provision in another contract, whereas here you have a number of contract and agency factors that would justify so. The first factor
isn't that circular where you have a number of references that would make it so? I mean, don't we have to be a little more precise to get from there to assent?
Certainly, Your Honor. And that is by the third-party beneficiary clause, which doesn't carve out the arbitration provision within the CCAA. The three or four references of the CCAs within the agreement, where you have multiple cross references to the contract containing the arbitration clause.
Why does it matter if you have multiple references or one reference or two?
Well, Your Honor, it demonstrates a familiarity or a knowledge that this, a sophisticated party like IDB, if it's referring to those contracts on so many places in a two-page agreement, it had to know what those contracts said.
All right, but even if you're correct, isn't it the case that IDB is not suing as a third-party beneficiary under the CCAA? It's suing as a party to the bailment agreement to enforce a right that's created by the bailment agreement, which doesn't contain an arbitration clause.
That is the way that the plaintiff, IDB, characterizes claims, Your Honor, and that is the way the Vice Chancellor agreed to characterize the claims. And we submit that when you look at the totality of this relationship, that the claims do not solely arise out of the bailment agreement. The claims must make reference to the CCAAs in order for them to have meaning. In order for IDB to give instructions, it must refer to the accounts created under the CCAAs.
I'm just warning you, you're into your rebuttal time if you want to save it.
I was going to go down a little bit more, Your Honor, but I'm happy if the court has any more questions. I would just focus on the three things that makes this case unique, and I would refer the court to the circumstances in the BAPO case, the Oryx decision, and the Westendorf decision, where they're looking at the totality of the relationship between the parties, between the signatory and the non-signatory, and the circumstances that these contracts were made. I would ask the court to look at the principles of contract and agency that apply here under the DuPont-Rolonc decision, as articulated in the NAMA Holdings case, which are express third-party beneficiary, not intended or implicit, numerous incorporation by reference, the acceptance of the benefits of the CCAAs for a number of years, and where the claims overlap, that under those circumstances, this court can hold the non-signatory under the specialized circumstances of this case to the arbitration provision in the CCAAs. And I will reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Joe Cicero from Cousins Chipman and Brown on behalf of Israel Discount Bank. With me here today is my colleague Paul Brown.
Good morning.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the court below because it properly exercised jurisdiction over IDB's claims for three primary reasons. First, the bailment agreement is the operative contract, not the CCAAs, and therefore there was no clear expression of an intent to arbitrate by the parties to that agreement. Secondly, the depository's own custody agreements, or CCAAs, are not the operative contracts, and they cannot be plausibly read together as an integrated contract with the bailment agreement, and IDB did not sue under the CCAAs in any capacity as a third-party beneficiary or otherwise. Third, even if this court finds that IDB's contract claims should be reversed and are required to be arbitrated, this court should affirm the court below's decision and judgment for conversion against CAMI, because that claim is predicated on rights outside the scope of any of the agreements we've just discussed. They are premised on security interest under certain loan agreements that do not have arbitration provisions. Under the first part, the bailment agreement being the operative contract, which Your Honors asked questions about, it is the only operative contract. The 2009 CCA was mooted early on, and the court acknowledged that it would probably parse that out for arbitration anyway. So the only contract at issue was the bailment agreement.
Well, as I understand the other side's position, all these contracts are interrelated and there are references, incorporations by reference. What's wrong with that?
There are references. There's certainly referrals to generic contracts. There's no reference specifically, and there's two parts to this answer. There's no specific reference to the CCAAs, or that there were multiple, there were numerous ones, but there are references to these contracts with First Aid. I don't think that's enough to integrate these two agreements or even to graft the arbitration provision from those agreements into the bailment agreement. It says nothing about arbitration. It merely references contracts. In fact, it says it's referencing the property at issue. and it's bigger than just property stored under the contracts. It's any property of Republic that's which may be shipped to and stored with Bailey from time to time, and it references those contracts. It didn't have to be the specific CCAAs that we're dealing with, and it didn't have to be a CCA with an arbitration provision. It could have been any arrangement that the Bailey came to with Republic. This is simply a separate agreement saying we have a security interest here, and we're at our election, we can command what happens. This is our ultimate property, and therefore you can have your agreements. We're third parties to that, third party beneficiaries to that, because if we need to enforce something else in those agreements that's not included in this bailment agreement, we can. But these should not be read together as a one integrated contract and pulling over that arbitration provision.
So your point is that because these are separate agreements, they're not integrated. There is, and the agreement that's being sued on does not contain an arbitration provision. For an obligation to arbitrate to be implied here, there would have to be a very specific reference to the CCAA arbitration provision.
There would be, Your Honor, and that's exactly my position. And that's not done here. In fact,
okay. That argument presupposes that the two contracts are separate and they're not integrated. What if they were integrated? Would that change the result or the analysis?
If they were found to be integrated as one contract, meaning that the arbitration provision is applicable here, as if it's one contract.
Well, that's the question.
I think,
would the arbitration provision be applicable automatically if the two contracts were integrated?
If they were deemed as one contract, I think there's an argument that that's the case, and then you'd have to go through the traditional Willy-Gary analysis. So I would concede that that's true. I just don't think that's what we have here for multiple reasons. Opposing counsel mentioned...
So it's important to your position that we agree with your side and with the Vice Chancellor that these are not integrated agreements.
I think that's... I do believe that's a critical point to our argument. I think it changes the landscape the other direction if that's not the case. The reason I believe it's not integrated, other than, you know, it's not specifically referenced, there's a number of reasons. There was separate consideration for this agreement. It's separate. IDB did not sign the CCAAs. I think it's the Huff decision in the Court of Chancery, but the stating that the court must interpret contractual provisions in a way that gives effect to every term of the instrument when read as a whole. In this case, you have conflicting provisions with the bailment agreement and the CCAAs. The bailment agreement gives the rights to IDB to basically tell the bailee what to do with the property, and the CCAAs does not do that. The CCAAs gives the rights to Republic as well as to customers, and there could be conflicting instructions in that scenario. There's also an integration clause in the CCAAs. There's an example of that at in one of them at A203 at paragraph 16, and that essentially it's a traditional integration clause. It says this agreement, including any amendments, attachments, schedules, exhibits, constitutes the entire agreement and understanding between the parties related to the subject matter hereof, and no representations, inducements, promises, or agreements not included herein shall be of any force and effect.
Do you understand FSD's position to be that the two agreements are integrated?
I believe that's their position now. I wasn't clear that that was their position during their opening brief, but it appears when reading their reply brief that that's their position. And I think it's a faulty position based on the reasons I just said. In Huff, There was a similar scenario where there were two related agreements. They were signed on the same day. One of them had an arbitration provision. One did not. The one without the arbitration provision was a non-compete agreement. The other was a stock purchase agreement. They both had integration clauses, although I think as long as one has an integration clause, I don't think you can read them together as one document. They had conflicting terms, and the court said that it was impossible to infer an implicit contract between the parties to arbitrate disputes under the non-compete simply because the parties agreed to arbitrate in the stock purchase agreement. I think that's close to the scenario.
What you're saying is, yes, the agreements certainly are related, but that doesn't mean that they're integrated.
Absolutely correct, Justice Jacobs. Moreover, another reason, there's a disparateness of parties here. You have the bailment agreement was executed between Republic, First State, and IDB. But the CCAs, there's numerous CCAAs, they're executed by those, First State, Republic, and certain customers of Republic, which include CAMI, Lott, Ketterling. There's actually others referenced at Appendix B18. It shows a few other customers that had their own CCAAs. They were not signatories to this bailment agreement. They have their integration clause under their own separate CCAAs. They were not agreeing to integrate these agreements. And, of course, IDB did not sign the CCAAs.
So to put it in more general terms, I take it that one of your arguments is that even if there is a, quote, totality of the circumstances type test for determining whether there's an implied obligation to arbitrate, certainly one of the important factors in that test would be, are the parties all the same in the various contracts?
I agree with that, Your Honor. I do, even under a totality of circumstances test, I think the totality of the circumstances militates in favor of reading these contracts separately for that reason and for the other reasons I stated. They also were executed at different times. You have CAMI executing two of the CCAAs on the same day as the bailment agreement, but you have Ketterling executing about 4 months subsequent to that and Lott executing almost 2 years later. And then, of course, there's other agreements that weren't at issue in this case because I think the property was the issues with property were resolved prior to the litigation. Importantly, as noted during opposing counsel's argument, IDB sued to enforce the bailment agreement, not the CCAAs. And yes, it's a third-party beneficiary under the CCAAs, but it did not seek any relief arising out of that contract. It could have if there was a dispute regarding storage fees, something of that nature that's under the CCAAs. If they were being overcharged, they could step in as a third-party beneficiary and say, look, this isn't the deal. I have standing to do this, and I think then they would be forced to arbitrate such a dispute. But this scenario is under the bailment agreement.
So the relationship, or one of the relationships between the two contracts, is that they involve the same property.
That's correct. The CCAs, the property in the CCAs relate to the
right.
bailment agreement.
And the CCAs give FSD certain rights in that property as a depository, correct?
Yes.
And if there's a dispute about those rights or obligations, that is to be arbitrated, right?
That's correct.
The bailment agreement, however, is an agreement that creates separate rights in an unrelated party, that is IDB, rights that supersede, in some cases, the rights that FSD has under the CCAA.
That's correct, and I think Vice Chancellor Parsons said the same thing below.
All right, and there is no arbitration. If there's a right being enforced under that agreement, it is not one that has to be arbitrated.
That's correct, and these are sophisticated parties that clearly could have put it into this contract an arbitration provision. Opposing counsel noted that there was definitely a familiarity or knowledge of the CCAAs. Yeah, that's sure, there was. In fact, I'm sure they knew that there was an arbitration provision in the CCAAs, and they were sophisticated enough that if they wanted to arbitrate the dispute on the bailment agreement, the dispute that was central to their property, they would have included that, and they didn't.
I guess as a business matter, if they wanted to have control that superseded whatever control FSD had, they had to know what rights FSD had under the custody agreements.
I think it was central, in fact, as this dispute panned out, that it's clear that that was their goal, and in some instances that was thwarted by the conduct of the parties, but that was important to them as set forth at trial. That's really the central position on my end. There's no arbitration provision. They shouldn't be read together. I think the other side also goes into, going to the NAMA holdings, it's relying upon the DuPont Third Circuit decision, and that's the one about non-signatories being bound by an arbitration provision. Those were all in contexts that were different than this. In fact, the DuPont case was a case where the court found that the DuPont was not a third-party express third-party beneficiary to the contract. But even if it were to find that it was, it didn't need to arbitrate because it wasn't seeking relief under the agreement which contained arbitration provision. So it doesn't matter. DuPont doesn't matter to this dispute because here we have an express third-party beneficiary, but it's the same result. IDB is not suing to enforce rights under the contract with the arbitration clause. Defendants also argue that extra contractual arguments, agency principles, assignment principles, as to why IDB should be bound to the arbitration provision. I think they're all defeated by the fact that they weren't seeking relief under the CCAAs, but there's other factual findings that go against that. For example, appellants argue that CCAAs are client collateral, and therefore...
Well, do they cite any case that does support their position?
I don't think there's any case cited to... Sorry, can you repeat that, Your Honor?
Do they cite any case that supports their position?
No, I do not believe they cite a case that supports their position.
So the cases you're using your time for are cases that support your position?
That's correct. The court below found, as a factual matter, that the CCAs were not client collateral in any way, shape, or form. That's post-trial opinion, page 45 to 46. At the same place in the opinion, the court also stated that Republic did not assign the CCAs to IDB. They just assigned loan agreements, and they also were not agents.
No, does your discussion of the cases that support your position advance the argument conceptually? That is, can we figure that out from your briefs, or is there something that we need to know?
Well, I believe this is in the reply brief. They're just misstatements of the fact below. There's just one more, and I just want to put it on the record. That they argue that Republic acted as an agent for IDB. Actually, the court found to the contrary, that Republic did not act as an agent of IDB, but acted contrary to IDB's authority, which is not something an agent would do. And that's also post-trial opinion, page 46 to 47. That's all I have, Your Honors, unless you have further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, a few points with respect to some of the matters raised by Mr. Cicero. The IDB places great weight on the principle that you have to give meaning to every term of a contract. And we agree with that. And that's why we asked the court to take a hard look at the four corners of the bailment agreement and the language that IDB chose to where with the breadth of the third-party beneficiary clause, the incorporation by reference on numerous occasions, and the failure to eliminate reference to the arbitration provision. It could easily have drafted the bail-in agreement to stand on its own, but it did not. Also, I want to remind
the
court...
And just as easily, the parties could have put an arbitration clause in the bail-in agreement, but they did not, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Instead, they referred back to the contract with the arbitration clause four times. But they did not include a separate arbitration clause or any other dispute resolution procedure. With respect to the integrated relationship of the contract discussion, the contracts don't necessarily have to be integrated under the Court of Chancery decisions that we've relied upon. The courts have in Oryx and Bapo and Westendorf have found that they, under the essentially the totality of the circumstances, as the Chief Justice Steele characterized it, they were either interrelated or interdependent or part of a single comprehensive transaction. And we believe that these facts justify that finding. Also, the parties do not necessarily have to be the same. They can be related. In Oryx and Bapo, we see those types of fact patterns. Here, IDB is not a standalone party. IDB loans millions of dollars to Republic. Republic then loans money to CAMI and other borrowers, and FSD served as a designated depository under IDB's loan documents.
Well, I don't know what it means to say that IDB and FSD are related. Of course they're related. They've got a contract. But there's no relationship between IDB and the account holders. That is the owners of the gold bullion and the, you know, the property that's being that is in custody. So how does that advance the issue?
May I respond, Your Honor? My time's expired. Your Honor, the relationship is such that the collateral is IDB's collateral, and they are essentially the lender for the money that was loaned to purchase that collateral. So for those reasons, it's important that the parties are very related.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take this matter under advisement and recess.
We decline.